All right, so this morning I'd like to begin a conversation about mirroring. So how many of us looked in a mirror this morning? Okay, many of us. So I'll give you a couple minutes. Just turn to your neighbor and share with them what you saw in the mirror this morning. So show of hands, how many of us liked what they saw this morning? Just looked in the mirror and was like, I look fantastic. Yeah. How many of us took a look and like, I need a little help. Need some help, yeah. So you could say that one of the functions of a mirror is it helps us see what we can't see, correct? So several years ago, some of you know the Dickersons, who used to be with us, and they used to own land in Elgin. And several years back, they had a birthday party for their son, Mason, who's the same age as my son, Joshua. And they decided they were going to play paintball. It was fathers versus sons. And here's a picture of me getting ready. And so somehow, I don't know how this happened, all the sons, the teenagers, got like the machine guns. Like you just press the button and paint just comes flying out of it. And then the dads, the old guys, got like the pistols. So we're losing, the sun's setting. At one point, I'm behind a tree with a pistol. The boys all know I'm there. So every time I peek up my head, I just get just raining paint. So my quads start getting tired. Visibility's low, and I decide to take a seat. This is a very Texas story, by the way. And as I'm sitting, quads are burning, visibility's low, I sit down on a cactus. Okay. So I'm not allowed to tell you the rest of the story. I talk to the pastors, they're like, this story's inappropriate. And I go, but I thought we're growing in our vulnerability. They're like, too much vulnerability. This is the line. Don't cross the line. So I'm not going to share the end of the story. I'll just say a couple things. I needed help seeing what I couldn't see. I'll just leave it at that. And one of the things I'm most proud of, I actually thought about asking my son Joshua for help. I'll say, oh, I'll just ask Joshua for help. And I chose not to. Which is a great parenting decision. I'm very proud of it. Saved years of therapy for me. So you could say mirrors help us see what we can't see. Too much still across the line still? Sorry, I really apologize. To the middle schoolers, I'm so sorry. But I think you could say the same thing emotionally, spiritually, psychologically. That we need help seeing what we can't see. This metaphor throughout the scriptures is actually prominent. That Paul talks about how God in his glory is mirroring to us that we have divinity, that we're made in the image of God. But we don't know it. God's mirroring that to us. James talks about how the scriptures mirror to us meaning. And when we look at it, we shouldn't forget that. It's trying to show us something. And so the question I want to ask this morning is, what do we need help seeing? All right, so before we go there, I wanted to ask this question. What percent of who you are do you think you can see? I think when I was elementary school, I probably would have said like 90, right? Probably as a teenager, like 70. In my 20s, I probably went to 50. You know, it just keeps going down. So I'm seeing a Jungian analyst, the therapist, and I asked him. So he was a former Episcopal priest for 30 years. He was an Episcopal bishop. Now he's a psychotherapist. And I go, what do you think is the amount that we can see? And he goes, well, and this is for someone who's done years of work, years of theology, like prayer, done a ton of work. He goes, I think like the most healthy people I meet can probably see 5%. I was like, oh, I think I would have put me at 5. If you're at 5, I'm like at 0.5. But all that to say, most of who we are, we actually can't see, and we need help seeing. And so this morning, I wanted to begin a conversation about that. We're going to be in Matthew chapter 18. We're going to have it on the screens. We'll start from verse 15. Read it aloud with a neighbor, and then we'll walk through it. All right? All right. Let's pick this up in verse 15. So it says, if another member of the church sins against you, go ahead and point out the fault. So Jesus tells the story from the perspective of the victim, which I actually think is genius. because when you've been violated, when you're the victim, there's actually internal feedback, right? So he's like, we all know what that feels like. So if someone's wronged you, go point it out with them alone. The member listens to you, you have regained that one. But if you're not listened to, take two or three friends with you so that every word may be confirmed by the evidence of two or three witnesses. If the member refuses to listen to them, tell it to the church. So I think he's trying to tell us something about how the church functions, maybe. And if the offender refuses to listen even to the church, let such a one be to you as a Gentile or a tax collector or someone who's not safe. He's speaking their language there. Okay. So this has generally been used appropriately as a text for conflict management or if someone hurts you. Okay. I think that's appropriate. I think that's one level and a way to read it. I think there's another level that's as appropriate, and I actually think the rest of the text supports this. So I think he's also saying, if you happen to hurt someone else, so if 95% of what we do and who we are, we can't really see, a lot of what we're not conscious of, we can probably hurt someone, right? But the problem is we don't have internal feedback. Like you can hurt someone just like, oh, that was fun, right? So if we want to see how we've hurt them, he's like, well, the person you've hurt should come tell you alone. If that doesn't work, bring some friends. They're trying to mirror, they're trying to show you what you couldn't see and how you may have hurt them. And then he says, then bring it to the church. Maybe this is the function of the church. So maybe a question we can ask here is this. Who has permission in our lives to help us see what we can't see? All right, I'll give you a couple examples and I'll give you an example from scripture. So growing up for years, my dentists, multiple dentists would ask, hey, do you grind your teeth? And with confidence, I'd go, no. So you would think after like several different dentists, you know, I would think about it. I go, maybe I do grind my teeth. But for years, I was just like, nope, don't grind my teeth. And then I got married. And the first week I was married, I was sleeping. And then I woke up one night to someone doing this to my face. And I open my, it's kind of a jarring way to wake up. Like I feel this, I'm like, what do you want? And she goes, you're grinding your teeth. I was like, I don't grind my teeth. She's like, you're totally grinding your teeth, right? And it just makes sense that I'm sleeping, right? I can't tell what I'm doing. And I think families at its best, this is why families are so hard and messy, but at its best can be healing. Because the people closest to us can see us the best, and they can see things we can't, and they're trying to show us something. We do it in awkward and hurtful ways, and it feels really hurtful. But at its best, if we can do it well, it can be healing, correct? And I propose that perhaps the church, that's why the church is so messy, but at its best can be healing. Because if we live life long enough together, we're going to start showing each other things we can't see. Our instinct is going to be to run because it feels easier just to start again to go to another church. But if we just sit with it and go, maybe this person's showing me something I can't see. Does it make sense? So I'll give you a personal example. So in the fall, I gave a homily on artistry and I felt pretty good about it, which is rare. You know, I was kind of proud of myself. I had this one idea. I usually quote other people. And in this homily, I quoted people at Fox. I was like, ah, pretty good idea. So on Tuesday at staff meeting, we usually kind of talk through how the liturgy went. And I was like, you know, they're going to tell me what a great idea that was. It's going to be amazing. Can't wait for staff meeting. And then so we're going around and then Amy goes, I say, hey, kid, can I ask you something? I was like, sure. You want to ask me how good of an idea that was? And she goes, I noticed that everyone you quoted, all the Vox artists, were male. I quoted Brandon Dickerson, Brandon Kinder, Joe Crisfaletti, I think Tim Bauer. And then I just, not even conscious, right? I did what I've been perfecting for 40-some years now, defending myself. I go, well, I did email all of the different artists at Vox, and only the males got back to me. But in truth, gender wasn't on my radar at all because I'm a dude. Right? When you have power, you have more blind spots. So I'm looking around the table looking for affirmation. They're all kind of like, yeah, they're kind of all dudes. It's on you, right? I was like, no. But Amy was trying to help me see something I couldn't see. Does that make sense? So in the scriptures, there's this pretty interesting case study and interaction between Peter and Paul. And so for years throughout the scriptures, God would tell about his love for all people. That's what the prophets would talk about. But we couldn't handle it. Our development of consciousness couldn't receive that. So we would hear all people and we go, oh, our people. So that's how the church functioned for years. So Peter's leading the church and then God just gives him this dream and this vision. And then just the whole fence is expanded. You've lived as if I meant this for our people, but this is all people. He has this vision and it's not, no one's clean or unclean. So he does something that's unbelievably revolutionary. In an ancient culture, he starts eating and dining with all people. All people are suddenly welcome to the table. And then time goes on. He gets pressure from the religious establishment, the conservative fundamentalists, and he flip-flops. He goes back to eating with just his people. And then Paul shows up and Paul's like, what? What are we doing? And so I imagine Peter just kind of like, oh, this is fine. It's actually a little easier. And then Paul shows up as a mirror and he's so in his face. He's a little intense. He hasn't had any nonviolent communication training yet. Like he needs some skills, like it's a little much. But I like this icon. So it's an icon of Peter and Paul. I think Paul's bald. And it looks like they're hugging, right? They probably are. But I like to imagine Paul whispering in Peter's ear as they're hugging, stop being racist. And I think that's a beautiful picture of the church. Because that's love, that's mirroring, that's how we grow and are healed. We need help seeing what we can't see. You guys are following. So spiritual practice here could be this. So who are your two or three trusted mirrors? Okay, consider. And then give them permission to ask for permission. So even the people you give permission to, before they start mirroring back, they should ask for permission. Because sometimes you're just not ready. It's not going to be helpful. Okay, but who are those people in our lives? All right, let's keep going. Verse 18. So he kind of gets to the heart of what he's actually trying to talk about, what Christ is talking about here. He goes, truly I tell you, whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven. Whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven. He's like, they're one and the same. They're not separate spheres. There's not this duality of what's spiritual and what's not. It's all the same, he's saying. He says, again, I tell you, if two of you agree on earth about anything you ask, it will be done for you by my Father in heaven. For where two or three are gathered in my name, what does it say? I am there among them. He's saying there's no duality. There's no this is spiritual and that's not. It's all spiritual. And we don't understand God in this spiritual, like theoretical vacuum. You actually come to know and experience God through the community. So you could say it this, right? Go to the next slide. So he's saying where two or three are gathered, go to the next slide. I'm in that space. As you're learning to love and show each other what you can't see, I'm there among them. I think this is what St. John of the Cross means when he says, God refuses to be known, can only be experienced or loved. You can't just understand it cognitively. You experience it together as you're doing this with people. Are you guys, following? Okay. Then Peter asks this question. So Jesus switches now. He's talking about God. Peter still thinks he's talking about him as the victim. So Peter asks this question. He goes, so go to the next slide. So Lord, he's still talking about him as the victim. If another member of the church sins against me, and I think Jesus answers his question, but is actually talking about God. Does that make sense? So Peter goes, how many times should I forgive? Seven? Right? And Jesus, not seven times, but 77 or 77 times, like the perfect amount, the limitless amount of times. For the offender and the enemy, how many times should we forgive? It's limitless. So let me ask a question. Why does Jesus ask repeatedly for us to love our enemies? Like that seems to be the main theme, right? Like people who hurt us, we're supposed to love and forgive them. Why? Because he wants us to be nice, right? God likes nice people. God's uncomfortable with conflict. He's conflict avoidant. So he's like, if everyone can just get along, right? Or what if it's this? What if what we think of the other, it informs us of who we are and what we think of God? If you don't think that you can forgive limitlessly, I doubt that the God you believe in will forgive limitlessly. And perhaps what we think of the other is actually showing us something about ourselves and then informs our perception of God. Let me give you an example. Do you guys listen to the This American Life episode about Homer, Alaska? Anyone hear that? Okay. So Homer, Alaska is this distant, small town, like in the corner of Alaska. So they describe how long it takes to get there. So if you're trying to get to this town, if you drive there, so imagine driving to the border of Washington State and Canada, British Columbia. Then to get to Homer, Alaska, you have to drive another 2,500 miles north. That's the same distance as New York to Seattle. Okay? Then you get to the border of Alaska, you have to drive another 11 hours to Homer. Like their slogan is the end of the road. Okay? So in this town, immigrants don't go there. They don't have any cases of undocumented immigrants that show up. After the last election, they had these huge, massive battles about immigration, like huge, colossal. And then just to make it clear that this isn't a thing that happens in the town, they're unaffected by this. The reporter actually interviews some people and asks.
Not their issue.
Are you aware of any undocumented immigrants in Homer?
No.
Do you have any memory of there being an undocumented immigrant in Homer?
No.
Have you ever heard of an undocumented immigrant in Homer?
No.
Have you ever heard of an undocumented immigrant being in Homer? In your almost 40 years here, have you ever?
No.
I've asked pretty much everyone I talk to the same question. I heard a couple stories about some people in town who are undocumented at one point or another, but it's rare. I asked the Homer police chief about it. He sent me this email, quote, "Brian, Homer is not a destination for immigrants, illegal or legal, and it never has been. The Homer Police Department is not aware of any immigrants in our area." Mark Robel, chief of police, Homer Police Department.
All right, so they're just trying to make it clear. It's like it doesn't impact their community at all. And then after the election, they had these massive, massive divisive battles about immigration. So they follow this one guy, and in his story, by the end of it, because of this, he's sitting at home crying. His wife has been married to him for years. They have children. It's the third time she's ever seen him cry. Like, this is impacting him in a huge way. So if you listen to the episode, does it tell us anything about immigrants? Does it tell us a lot about the people who live in Homer, Alaska? So they think they're talking about the other, but they're actually telling us about themselves. Does that make sense? And when we have these huge, massive conversations, we think we're talking about the other. We think we're talking about gender. We think we're talking about politics. We think we're talking about sexuality. But most of the time, it's probably revealing who we are and informs us of what we think of God. And so maybe a question we can ask here is this. What do we think of the other? So just pick someone in your mind, or probably because of what happened yesterday, we can all just say white nationalists. What do we think of them? What are some adjectives we'd use? What does that inform us about who we are? There's a priest in Ireland. His name is Padraig Tuama. And he says it like this. He says, "We infuse words with a sense of who we are. Therefore, you're not just saying a word. You're communicating something that feels like your soul. It might even be your soul." Okay, so we're going to keep going. I'll give us something practical at the end to practice. Then he tells the story, okay? So he's kind of wrapping the whole teaching background in this story. He says, the kingdom of heaven can be compared to, or the kingdom of heaven is like. And so he tells of this king, and then this servant owes him 10,000 talents. So a talent in today's equivalent would be 1.2 million. So 10,000 talents would be 12 million. So this guy owes him 12 million. None of us knows what that means or feels like. So just imagine everything you own. You owe, Okay. Or imagine the biggest debt you have, your mortgage, car payment, student debts, and then suddenly canceled in the story. The king cancels it. Gone. Then the servant goes back, and then someone else owes him $5,000. And then in the story, go to the next slide. What I like about this, I like how visual this is. The guy can't pay him back, and then what does he do? He chokes him. He enacts violence on him. But again, he's not the victim, so there's no feedback. He's just like, oh, that was awesome, right? My debt's canceled, and then this guy got to choke him, throws him in prison. And then it says, everyone else saw it. The other servant saw it. And then they go back and they, so everyone can see our stuff, but we can't see it. Then he goes back and tells the king. And then this is the king's response. He says, should you not have mercy on your fellow servant as I had? I'm trying to mirror to you. I'm trying to show you what mercy looks like so that you can practice it, but you can't. Then in his anger, the Lord handed him over to be tortured until he would pay his entire debt. I think what this means is if you can't see your own stuff, you're going to live a tortured life. If you're able to receive mercy and you can't give it, the choices you make will torture you. And then I think that last part of the verse means you're going to project that onto God. You're going to think that God's doing that to you. All right. So, most often this is taught as a story on forgiveness, which I think it is. I think that's appropriate. But I would propose this is as much, if not a story about awareness, than it is forgiveness. And I think if we're not aware of our needs and we don't know what we need and we're blind to it, it'll come out as violence. So maybe we can say it like this. Our unhealed needs, the things we don't know, if we don't know what they are, will enact violence on other people. So most of us go, well, we're not violent people. So we could say it like this. Our unhealed needs show up as violence, or they probably show up first as judgments when we start judging other people, or when other people irritate us. Does that make sense? Or we could say it like this. Our judgments and irritations are helpful engine lights of our unhealed needs. There's something in us, there's a need that we don't know, and it's starting to surface. I'll tell you a story that I went through. So I think last month I told you how I went up to Detroit. And so we drove there as a family. It's a long drive, arguably not very pretty, straight up the middle of the country. Our last day, we drove from Arkansas to Detroit. It was a 13-hour day. We were exhausted. We showed up in Detroit around midnight. So my parents and my in-laws, they were going to drive down from Toronto, which is like about a four-hour drive, to meet us. So as we're getting at midnight, I was exhausted. And we texted my parents, and I go, hey, we're excited to see you all tomorrow. We're exhausted. We had a really long day in the car. If you could give us the day to rest, we just need to recover, and we'll meet you for dinner. They texted back, you want to meet for lunch? And we go, we're exhausted. We're excited to see you. We really need the day to rest, and we can't wait to meet. We'll see you all for dinner. So we go to bed, wake up the next morning. Everyone else is still in bed. I'm sitting with my cup of coffee. It's 9 a.m. and I hear a knock on the door. And I remember staring at the door, just like anger, just like judgment, irritation, just like, oh, right? So I didn't know what was happening. I didn't know what to do with all that. So for weeks, I was just judging everybody and anything and irritated, like so much irritation. You fast forward like 2 to 3 weeks. I'm processing this. I don't know what to do with it. We're sitting in the nonviolent communication workshop practice. And then Karen's my partner, and we're supposed to pick something that we're going through. So I was like, oh, let's do this one. And I still couldn't really name it. Like, I knew it was really upsetting, but it was just kind of like right here. And I was like, ah, oh, but I was feeling all this weight. And so we look at the list of feelings. So I think I have the list on there. And then I couldn't really pick one. It felt like too much. I was like, I'm feeling all of the negative ones, like all of them. And then we're going back and forth. And then Karen goes to, if you see on the bottom left, she's like, helpless. Do you think you felt helpless? I was like, yes, I felt helpless. Then I was like, what was my need then? You go to the next slide. I'm going through and I was like, I have all of these needs. I need everything. And she goes, I wonder, you were feeling helpless because of your need to be heard, your need for autonomy. And right when she named that, it was like this burden lift. I was like, oh, okay. I know what my need is and I can ask for it now. And in that moment, I was actually able to offer more empathy to my parents. Like in that moment when I named my need, I was like, I kind of get it. Actually, traffic in Toronto was terrible. All of their friends were warning them to leave early. I drove to Toronto later. I experienced that traffic. Like it started to make sense. And I was like, okay, but I have this need. And maybe I can begin to learn to care for this need. In The Way to Love, Anthony DeMello, in this beautiful little book, he says it like this. How could you go about creating a happy, loving, peaceful world? I think this quote, especially in light of events this weekend, I think is so, so, so important. How can we actually contribute to a different world, he's saying. It says, by learning a simple, beautiful, but painful art called the art of looking or the art of seeing, this is how you do it. Every time you find yourself irritated or angry with someone, the one to look at is not that person, but yourself. The question to ask is not, what's wrong with this person, but what does this irritation tell me about myself? Then he goes this, he says this, think of some irritating person you know and say this is painful, but say this painful but liberating sentence to yourself. The cause of my irritation is not in this person, but in me. So maybe a spiritual practice here could be this. So think of an irritating person, okay? You got their face in your mind. On the count of three, point to them. I'm just kidding, don't do that. So think of an irritating person. Ask, what is it that irritates you? Just kind of name it. Write it out. And what does this irritation then tell me about myself? And I often can't do it by myself, so maybe your 2 to 3 trusted mirrors can help you with it. And so I'll just close with this. Many of us woke up perhaps to this news page this morning. And then in the tragedy of what happened yesterday. And we need to fight for injustice. We need to grieve with those who've lost lives and have been hurt. But for us this morning, Vox, this is my prayer for us. That it's not us versus them. It's not our people versus their people. It's about all people. It's about God's limitless, boundless love. It's about God's love and then all of us. God is evangelizing all of us. And as Peter subconsciously asked, and I think we're still asking, how limitless is God's forgiveness and love? And Jesus answers, it's 77 times 7. It's limitless. And as Paul says it like this, for now we see in a mirror dimly. We see love, but we can barely see it. But one day we'll see it face to face. And now we only know in part, but then we'll know fully as we are being fully known. Because he tells us that God is patient, God is kind, God is not envious or boastful or arrogant or rude. God does not insist on his own way, is not irritable or resentful. God does not rejoice in wrongdoing, but rejoices in the truth. God bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. And then he says, and now faith, hope, and love remain. And of these three, the greatest of these is love. And so, Vox, may love mirror to us less dimly each day, more brightly into a love and forgiveness that we can know fully. May we have faith that this is possible. May we have hope, not just for our people, but for all people. And may great love mirror back to us until all of us, rich, poor, Republican, Democrat, Black, Brown, Asian, white, and yes, even white nationalists, can be mirrored into love and healed by the limitless love of God. And so, Vox, when the gentleness between us hardens and we fall out of our belonging with each other, may the depths we have reached hold us still. When no true word can be said or heard, and when we mirror each other in the script of hurt, when even the silence has become raw and torn, may we hear again an echo of our fierce music. When the weave of affection starts to unravel and anger begins to sear the ground between us, before this weather of grief invites the black seed of bitterness to find root, may our souls come to kiss. Box, now is the time for us to be gracious, to allow a kindness beyond thought and hurt, to reach out with sure hands, to take the chalice of our love, and to carry it through this echoless waste until winter pilgrimage leads us towards the gateway to spring. And we pray all of this in the limitless love of God, the mercy of Christ, and the gentleness of the Holy Spirit. Amen.